started moving away from food and started moving towards a lowest common denominator called a calorie. In right around the 1970s, when the government started getting involved in our diet and when they started telling us to eat less and exercise more, and ironically, at the very start of the obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and heart disease epidemic. And the idea was if we could just have one simple measure that equivalence classed all food and all physical activity, for that matter, that it would simplify things and that we would all be healthier and fitter as a result. And it is a simplification, but it's a simplification a bit like saying the sum of any two numbers is 43. It's simple, but it's patently wrong. Not all foods are the same, and they cannot be dumbed down with one single metric. And by doing so, we've ended up in the horrible mess we are today with all the disease and obesity that we are today, simply because it is a proven incorrect model.
Can you share some of the... You take some of these assumptions to their logical conclusions in the calorie myth. For instance, if we cut a certain amount of food or calories out of our diet, or looking at how much more calories we eat over decades as a population, we should see a certain amount of weight gain that we don't see. Can you share some of those with our listeners?
One of my favorite studies on this subject came from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And what they did is a deep analysis of our actual caloric consumption. And what they found is that in 2006, the average American was consuming about 570 more calories per person per day than we were when we were relatively weight stable as a country in the 1970s. And the conclusion of that paper was, see, we're just eating too much. But what my research showed is that really misses the point, because if you look at the actual metabolic math, we've all been taught, let's say that that data is true, which it more than likely is, very reputable research institution, let's say the average American in 2006 was consuming 570 more calories per day than he or she needed. Well, we can do that metabolic math very simply. You take 570 calories, you multiply it by 365 days in a year, and you multiply it by the 8 years in between 2006 and now. And if metabolic math was correct, during that 8-year time period, the average American should have gained about 476 pounds. And obviously we haven't. We haven't even gained a fraction of that. In fact, over the past 40 years, the average American has gained 20 pounds. So how do we account for this flagrant misunderstanding of biology?
And what is your answer? How do we account for the fact that we're eating 500 more calories a day, but we're not gaining 400 pounds over 8 years?
Energy balance works like every other system in our body, but we've been led to believe that it doesn't. For example, take your blood sugar or your blood pressure, right? If your blood sugar goes up, your body takes steps to bring it back down. If it goes down, your body takes steps to bring it back up. Or your body temperature, if you go into a cold room, what happens? You start to shiver. Your body takes steps to warm you up. We all learned about, in high school biology, this term called homeostasis, which is every biological organism in the known universe works to maintain a balance, a range in which life can exist. There's a reason there's no life on the moon, but there is life on the planet Earth. We have a different range of temperatures and atmospheric pressure, for example. Body works the same way. It's not that calories don't exist. It's not that calories don't matter. It's not that if we eat 10,000 calories a day consistently, we won't gain fat. It's that this myth that we need to consciously and precisely balance calories in with calories out has to be wrong, because that's not how the body works. We have a portion of our brain called our hypothalamus, which is designed to automatically balance life-sustaining functions. Calories are just one of those. It's the same logic we don't need to the same logic that shows us we don't need to consciously count milligrams of vitamin C in and milligrams of vitamin C out. We need vitamin C. It's essential for life. But we don't have to consciously balance it. So why are we to believe that we have to do that for calories?
We're talking today with Jonathan Baylor, the author of The Calorie Myth, How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. So Jonathan, at the top of the show, you mentioned that the calorie model says that it's how many calories go in and how many we burn that matters, not the type of foods that we eat. But in fact, you're arguing that there's two foods with the same calories can have extremely different effects in the body. So if eating more, if eating less and exercising more isn't the answer, what exactly is the answer?
The answer is to eat more of the foods that don't break that homeostatic regulating system. Because that's really what the research community has shown over the past 40 years. There's been dramatic advancement. And what we've actually seen is that the cause of chronic weight gain, this is the type of weight gain where individuals go on these super restrictive diets and fail continuously 95%+ of the time, not because they're not trying hard, but because they don't work. The reason for this is obesity is much more analogous to diabetes than it is to some sort of character flaw. We notice characteristic and consistent inflammation in the brain. We notice characteristic and consistent dysregulation of hormones, as well as disruption of gut bacteria. But when we eat the proper quality of foods, more of them, in fact, so much of them that we're too full for the unnatural edible products that cause this metabolic, neurological, and endocrinological dysfunction, we heal the underlying system, and we enable our bodies to pursue slimness naturally rather than obesity naturally. And while that may seem too good to be true, it's actually too obvious to be false, because before anyone knew what a calorie was, we were all slimmer and healthier, and everyone ate till they're full and stopped when they're satisfied. And every other species on the planet, when left to their own devices, seems to avoid obesity effortlessly. We're not broken by default, but we've been fed incorrect information and poisonous edible products that have broken that system.
So what are good quality calories? What do you use as your metric to figure out what we should be eating and not eating?
The most general statement we can make is if it's found directly in nature, you're on the right track. So think things like vegetables, meats, fish, fruit, nuts, seeds, from the highest of levels. We can now refine that by using the four factors that the research community has established that differentiate one calorie from another. I abbreviate those four factors using the acronym SANE, which stands for satisfying calories, unaggressive calories, nutritious, and then inefficient calories.
And can you elaborate on each of those?
Sure. Satisfying calories are calories that fill us up quickly and keep us full for a long time. For example, there's a popular snack food which tells us that once we pop, we cannot stop. That quote-unquote food is advertising that eating calories from it will actually make you hungrier. That's not a good idea. So we want to eat satisfying calories, not unsatisfying calories. We want to eat unaggressive calories. These are calories that disperse their, let's call it, energy payload into our bloodstream gradually and don't cause a bunch of hormonal chaos. Very similar to glycemic index and glycemic load. We want to eat unaggressive calories that give us energy gradually. We want to eat nutritious calories. These are calories that provide us the most of what we need, that which is essential for life. Vitamins, minerals, amino acids, fatty acids, and the least of what we don't need, say, simple sugars. And then finally, we want to eat inefficient calories. All things being equal, there are calories, for example, such as protein, which are incredibly difficult for the body to store its fat, simply because protein is not an energy source, it's a structural component, whereas things like starch or sugar are very efficiently stored as body fat. So all things being equal, we would burn more fat eating inefficient calories.
So can you name some of the better foods and some of the worst foods in the SANE model of calorie differentiation?
The best foods on the planet are without question non-starchy vegetables. These are vegetables you could eat raw. You don't have to eat them raw, but you could. Think foods you would find in salads, green leafy vegetables, peppers, mushrooms, cucumbers, asparagus, broccoli. Saute them, eat them raw, however you can get them in your body. They should be about 50% of our plate every time we eat. The next sanest substance in the world would be what I like to call nutrient-dense proteins. These are humanely raised animals, wild-caught seafood, things like that. And then whole food fats, so nuts and seeds, especially things like avocados, macadamia nuts, coconut, cocoa, chia seeds, flax seeds, olives, excellent healthy whole food fat sources. And then finally, low fructose fruits, things like berries and citrus fruits. If we can eat so much of those that we're too full for insane edible products, such as processed starches, processed sweets and unnatural trans fats, we will be shocked at how delicious and slim healthy can become. Or delicious and simple, excuse me.
Right. So what about, you mentioned obviously the refined sugars and the refined starches as being bad. What about foods like beans or vegetables that aren't edible raw, so the starchy vegetables, and also whole grains? Do you consider those things that people should avoid, like the refined flours and the refined sugars, or are those okay in the calorie myth diet?
It's less about is something okay and more about is eating it your best option. The thing we have to keep in mind is that eating is a zero-sum game. And that's an economic term which says if we do one thing, we're not just doing that thing, we're also not doing something else. So, for example, what a lot of people end up doing is they hear that whole grains are healthy. So they fill their plate up with grains instead of vegetables. So they actually displace vegetables in their diet with grains or with starches. So I'm not a fan of grains. And what I think is somewhat irrelevant, if we actually look at the research and we look at, for example, the nutritional density and the hormonal healing capabilities of grains versus vegetables, it seems like we would all be better off simply eating 3, 4, 5 times more vegetables in place of those grains. The same thing applies with legumes. Will they kill you? Absolutely not. I eat legumes on occasion, but it's just that we want to make sure that these not optimal foods, they're not deadly, but not optimal foods aren't displacing those vegetables and those nutrient-dense proteins and those whole food fats.
And when you say the science shows that, can you refer our listeners to where it shows that whole grains and legumes are less nutritious than eating vegetables and animal products?
The best place to look is actually just math, because nutrient density is not an ambiguous or debatable thing. What you would do, for example, is you would take, say, 100 calories worth of wheat, and you would compare it to 100 calories of spinach. And then you would see that there are dramatically more vitamins and minerals in the spinach in 100 calories than there would be in the wheat in 100 calories. And then to make it further clear, if listeners really wanted to do this, if they have a friend that's diabetic or if they themselves is diabetic, what they could do is test their glucose levels after eating 100 calories worth of spinach and then test their blood glucose levels after eating 100 calories worth of wheat. And what they would see is that after 100 calories of wheat, their blood sugar would spike dramatically higher, and they would do that while getting dramatically fewer essential vitamins and minerals.
But wouldn't it be more relevant to a real-world situation not to compare 100 calories to 100 calories, but to, say, compare a third of a plate versus a third of a plate, since obviously you're going to be eating a lot more spinach to get 100 calories than you're going to be eating of the brown rice, let's say?
I don't think so, because I think we need to eat dramatically more vegetables. I think if you look at, for example, the teaching of many preeminent researchers, one of my favorite is Dr. Joel Fuhrman, or even if you look at a lot of T. Colin Campbell's work, what we consider to be a lot of vegetables is not a lot of vegetables. For example, if you're eating raw spinach, it would be very difficult to consume 100 calories of it. But if you were to eat a sautéed spinach, or just even cook the spinach, it would not be very difficult to consume 100 calories of spinach, and that's just spinach. If we move into things like Brussels sprouts, for example, or just any number of other vegetables, it's quite easy to eat quite a lot of them. And there's also an assumption implicit in this argument that, you know, well, where are we going to get our calories from? Certainly, you're right that we can't get our calories from vegetables. It'd be very difficult to eat, let's say, 2,000 calories worth of vegetables. But we could get our calories from healthy whole food fats. So the question then really comes, is a diet that's higher in healthy whole food fats and vegetables preferable to a diet that would be just healthy in starch? And I would argue the former would be a better choice.
We're talking today with Jonathan Baylor, the author of The Calorie Myth, How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. So Jonathan, let's touch a little bit on exercise. You have a similarly interesting approach to what good and bad exercise is. Lead us into that section of the book for our listeners.
The challenge with exercise is the same as with food, is it's been framed in terms of the calorie, which is a flawed argument, because just like telling a person, just consume, just eat, just take fewer calories in, it doesn't work, because the body will say, wait a second, no, I need calories, so I'm just going to make you hungry and slow down your metabolism in response to that. Just telling people to exercise more, while it may have other health benefits from a weight management perspective, just like jogging more makes you sweat more, which then makes you drink more because your body is trying to maintain balance, jogging more will make you burn more calories, but it will then cause you to eat more calories, and we all know that it's much easier to eat calories than it is to burn them. So often these approaches are not effective for weight loss. What we need to do is look at the forms of exercise that help us to heal metabolically, not that play this calorie game. And those forms of exercises are those that engage all of our muscle fibers very safely. These are things like very slow and heavy resistance training and very safe and non-impact interval or burst training.
And what do you mean by burst training?
For example, imagine getting on a stationary bike, one that looks like an actual bike, not one that looks like a recliner. And instead of just pedaling while watching television and maybe talking to a friend on the phone for an hour, what you would do is you would get warmed up, and then you would crank the resistance up so you have to stand up on the bike as if you're climbing a hill. And you would pedal as hard as you can for 30 seconds to a minute. You wouldn't be moving very fast because the resistance would be so high, but after about 30 or 60 seconds, you'd have to stop simply because you'd run out of energy. You then reduce the resistance and pedal very gradually for about 2 minutes till you got your breath back, and then you would repeat that 2 to 3 to 4 times. And in 10 to 15 minutes, you would cause a dramatically different and dramatically better metabolic impact on your body than you would have in an hour or even 2 hours of conventional quote-unquote cardio.
And have there been head-to-head studies regarding weight loss specifically around interval training versus sort of a moderate pace jogging or biking?
There have, and they've been shocking. There's been there's numerous that are referred to in the book, but for example, there are studies out of Canada where individuals would spend dramatically less time exercising and achieve the same or superior results from a weight loss perspective. And what's even more encouraging is actually the non-weight results in terms of cardiovascular protection, heart protection, and many of these studies are called out explicitly in my book.
What's interesting also, we used to think that weightlifting wouldn't have cardiovascular benefit, and it turns out that we're learning that it actually does.
That's exactly right, and it's also incredibly sustainable. That's the thing that I really like about these forms of exercise, is that not only can you do them throughout your life, but almost anyone can do them. This conventional wisdom of just go jog on pavement for an hour a day doesn't, not only is it inappropriate, but it is unhealthy for those individuals who quote-unquote need it the most. If you're a 350-pound individual who's diabetic, jogging on pavement for an hour is horrible for you, whereas doing slow, safe resistance training is incredibly healthy for you.
Well, we should say, though, that jogging has got health benefits, even if it doesn't have weight loss benefits. There's certainly a lot of studies on it regarding blood sugar control and cardiovascular benefit.
That's exactly right. And the thing to keep in mind in terms of exercise is it's a bit like eating. Two things. It's a zero-sum game. So if you spend your time jogging, you may not be able to spend your time doing something else. So I just like for people to be very specific on their goals. For example, if your goal is to run a marathon, well, you better spend your time jogging because that's going to help you achieve your goal. But if your goal is to, let's say you're a busy professional who has maybe 30 minutes a week to spend exercising, if you were to spend that 30 minutes jogging, you may not get the benefit you want. So I find that individuals get great success when they focus on a specific goal and then find the most sustainable, safe form of exercise that enables them to achieve that specific goal.
Well, back to the diet section of the calorie myth, Jonathan. What is your take on vegetarianism, and is it a path that somebody could take your calorie myth diet and still be a vegetarian? I think if we have listeners here who are and they're hearing low grain, low bean, low starchy vegetables, and they were to imagine taking out animal products, that would be quite a daunting and probably not a very balanced diet.
You can absolutely be what I call a sane vegetarian. The sane framework is really just taking the best science has to offer and saying, of whatever foods you choose to eat, be it you're a vegetarian, maybe you're low carb, maybe you're paleo, maybe you're kosher, maybe you're halal, whatever your food set that you currently have today is, you can apply this sane framework to optimize, to increase the satisfaction, decrease the hormonal chaos, increase the nutrition, and decrease the likelihood of storing body fat within that framework. So, for example, in a vegetarian lifestyle, some of the most wonderful success stories we've seen have been from vegetarians who've, quote-unquote, gone sane. In fact, we had a woman who was overweight, diabetic, and was unable to conceive a child for over 8 years. And after just a few months of sanitizing or just swapping in more plant fat instead of those plant-based starches, she dropped about 45 pounds, went off her diabetes medication completely under the advisement of her physician, and finally conceived a child. So what most sane vegetarians find is instead of getting their calories from sugar, which is what starch is, they simply switch to getting their calories from whole food plant fats, and they achieve dramatic health benefits.
Lastly, before we go, I'd be curious what your thoughts are on intermittent fasting. I know you talk a lot in the book about starving ourselves, it makes us worse off because our metabolism slows down so that we regain the weight and sometimes even more. But a lot of the research on intermittent fasting versus calorie reduction on every day seems to show a maintaining of muscle mass and potential cognitive benefits for animals. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that as playing a role in the calorie myth diet, or is that something you're opposed to?
It can absolutely play a role. I like to tell people that what my decade plus of research has shown is that focusing on the quality of the food you eat rather than the quantity is going to give you the most bang for your buck. And if you choose to eat a very high quality diet in 4 hours versus over the course of 16 hours, whatever is working best for you, as long as you're maximizing food quality, is a great choice.
And do you have any web resources if people are curious about this? Maybe this is the first time they're hearing about these theories and they want to look at more in the book?
Absolutely. Please check out CalorieMythBook.com. Again, that's CalorieMythBook.com. And what you'll find is it's quite amazing because far from these being, quote-unquote, my theories, what this book is an amalgamation of over 10,000 pages of academic research from top institutions such as Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and UCLA, showing that so much of what we've been told has been flatly proven wrong. So I hope it helps people.
And could you give some final thoughts to our listeners, Jonathan?
I would urge all of your listeners to really take a step back and say, how is it that we were all healthier and slimmer prior to any of us knowing what a calorie was, let alone counting them, and also appreciating the fact that all of these lifestyles that do work, for example, veganism, vegetarianism, South Beach, paleo, low carb, these lifestyles that have stood the test of time, you'll notice they have at least one thing in common. They focus on what you're eating, aka food quality, not how much. And that's why they work.
Well, it was great having you on Health Watch today.
Thank you so much, David.
We're talking today with author Jonathan Baylor about his book, The Calorie Myth, How to Eat More, Exercise Less, Lose Weight, and Live Better. If you missed part of today's program, you'll be able to go later today to kboo.fm/healthwatch and listen to this show and other shows from the archive. Or you can subscribe to Health Watch through iTunes. Just type in Health Watch one word into the podcast store search bar. And you've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and next up is Madness Radio. Thank you.
KBOO's Winter Membership Drive is right around the corner, starting on February 6th, and we need your help in raising $94,000. Can you show leadership by offering a matching gift of $500 or more? These generous matches have proven to be very successful in helping KBOO raise money. If you are interested, please call KBOO at 503-231-8032, extension 207, or email us at membership@kboo.org. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Hi, Love Jones here, DJ and producer for La Contessa de la Luna, late night host of The Confessional. I want to invite you to join her and a cast of tens to the Clinton Street Theater pre-Valentine's Day live show and extravaganza, plus movie. Get ready for Thursday, February 13th, when she takes over the Clinton Street Theater for a live show featuring sing-alongs, talk like Christopher Walken contest, prizes, raffles, audience confessions, and a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna, featuring the KBOO dancers. The live show is followed by the film Dogma, featuring George Carlin and Matt Damon. That's triple the entertainment for one ticket, and all proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's La Contessa and Friends live on stage Thursday, February 13th, starting at 7 p.m. Tickets on sale now at brownpapertickets.com. Just search for KBOO. See you there.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. And my guest today is Tomi Gomori. Tomi is associate professor at the College of Social Work at Florida State University. He teaches and researches on mental health and homelessness. His recent book is called Mad Science, Psychiatric Coercion, Diagnosis, and Drugs, co-authored with Stuart Kirk and David Cohen. Tomi, I want to welcome you to Madness Radio.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
I really am inspired by your new book, Mad Science. I recommend people check it out. It's a wealth of information about the history of psychiatry, as well as the sort of the dilemmas that we're in around failed treatments, and especially the role that psychiatry has come to play of being this coercive force, social control force, that we're going to be talking about on the show today, and how we could maybe develop some alternatives to that, or at least new ways of thinking about that. But maybe we should start out by just telling us about how you got interested in this field and how you came to have perspectives that are very different than the mainstream of mental health professionals.
I happen to be a refugee. As a young boy, I came out of Hungary, which was then under communist control in 1956. And so I came into the States essentially an alien, literally. I couldn't speak the language, so everything was brand new, and of course, I had to begin to learn all about what it was to be an American.
Do you think that your experience as an immigrant from Hungary and coming out of that background of communist rule and the Holocaust with your family, do you think that that sensitized you to the misuse of power and the way that ideology operates that Thomas Szasz talks about in the Myth of Mental Illness?
Oh, absolutely. Some people may know Tom Szasz is a Hungarian himself. He was about a generation or two ahead of me in terms of his age. I resonated to the control and the power that was exerted by the psychiatric establishment that I was working within.
Yeah, a lot of us have remarked that the contemporary mental health system does have a kind of authoritarian, monolithic side to it, kind of Kafkaesque bureaucracy that maybe could be reminiscent of communist Eastern Bloc country rule in some ways.
Well, of course, often psychiatrists critique, you know, the psychiatry of the Soviet Union as if it was, you know, the bad guy and look how good we are here. But I would argue fundamentally without the coercive authority that psychiatry is uniquely granted, you know, in medicine, it would be a very different kind of practice.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because people hear that phrase, the myth of mental illness, and it's very provocative because clearly something is going on with people. But let's talk about these ideas that contemporary science is promoting, that there are physical brain dysfunctions going on a physiological and neurological level, and that's what's behind mental illness, the idea that there are genetic differences, that some people have different genes and therefore they're more likely to be mentally ill. Tell us what your view is of that mainstream scientific understanding of so-called mental illness.
To use a fairly simplistic model of argument that Tom simply argued, he also felt that obviously the behaviors were very real and the problems and the experiences were very real. What he meant by the myth, of course, was that in his judgment these were not diseases of the brain or medical organic problems. And his simple argument was that if you have a brain,